The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Reports of hate crimes have soared since the bitter national election. Black lives don't matter and neither does your votes was spray painted across a wall in Durham, North Carolina, a day after the election. That same day, two students at a Pennsylvania vocational school were videotaped parading with a Trump sign shouting white power. A flurry of swastikas and variations of Trump Nation, whites only, has popped up on public buildings. All of these incidents have been confirmed or under investigation by law enforcement, as have several incidences of harassment and intimidation of Muslim women, including forcing them to remove their hijab. Others, like this YouTube post from a mall parking lot in Memphis, have not been independently verified and may never be reported.
White power!
A.C. Thompson is a staff writer for ProPublica, and Ken Schwenke is a data journalist. They've been tracking the surge in hate crimes for ProPublica and how difficult it is to track and even report these kind of crimes. Ken Schwenke, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
A.C., so glad you could join us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So that video was posted on November 7th, just before the election, and I've seen reports of surges in hate crimes before and since the election, but what does the data actually say?
So the data from the FBI's UCR report has upticked, and those are actual reports that have been reported to the police and then further reported up to the FBI. In New York, the NYPD has said that hate crimes have ticked upward, and they're actually creating a special unit, according to the governor. The statistics on hate crimes are sort of poorly kept, but from what we know, they appear to be tracking upward.
Okay, how much upward?
You go back to the most recent year that we have full data available. That's 2015. And what we see in that FBI nationwide data is we see about almost a 7% increase across the board in hate crimes. But then when you look at anti-Muslim hate crimes, that's where you get the real extreme rise. And so that's a 67% increase there in 2015. So that is going to be with the beginning of the presidential campaign.
So Muslims clearly targeted. How about other groups? Who's being affected?
You know, it's interesting because there's a very high number of anti-Jewish hate crimes, and those were up 9% in 2015. High number of crimes against African Americans, those were up 7.7%. Crimes against Latinos, by the numbers, look unchanged, about 300 of those nationwide. But the other really big category here is crimes against people due to their sexual orientation. And so you had more than 1,000 of those.
Well, it's been a lot of concerns about fake news stories that are shared on social media and get picked up and spread all around. So what did ProPublica use to track these kind of claims and numbers for accuracy?
So far, we have looked into the so our story was mostly about the publicly available data sources and how those are sort of inadequate. What we're looking to do now is to track reports from social media using a process we sort of perfected or started with Election Land, which was a project to track people's access to the vote. That involves looking at social media sources from, say, the Southern Poverty Law Center and other organizations that track that, and combining them in a way that we can sort of catalog them and track them.
What's inadequate about the numbers?
Yeah, so when it comes to the numbers, right, the FBI statistics rely on two things, A, that you reported them, and B, that the police then reported them upwards. Well, I guess three things, because also that the police adjudicated it as a crime, as a hate crime. We know that people don't necessarily report hate crimes because they're very personal. And in fact, the DOJ has estimates where they think up to 200,000 to 300,000 hate crimes may occur a year. And the vast majority of them go unreported to the police.
So these are federal offenses, right?
No. So what we're talking about here is both federal and state offenses. And in the case of the FBI data, what they're really looking at is state and local law enforcement. So they're looking at state cops, local cops, who should be documenting alleged hate crimes and then referring that information to the FBI. And what we find is that there are states that just don't participate at all. Like the state of Hawaii doesn't participate in this hate crimes collection project at all. And then there are states where the numbers are highly dubious, and frankly, I don't believe the numbers. So Alabama in 2015 said there were 10 hate crimes in the entire state. Arkansas said there were 5. Mississippi said there were 0. And I frankly don't think those are real numbers. I think what's happening is you have a problem at the front end with police officers actually documenting these incidents as hate crimes. And then you have a problem with the local and the state law enforcement agencies actually forwarding this information to the FBI like they're supposed to.
Oh, so let me just play this out in my head. So there's a fight at a bar, and the cops are called, and somebody was calling the other person in the N-word or something like that, and that started the fight. The local law enforcement is making a decision right there whether or not it was a hate crime?
Yeah, exactly. And what the federal law says is basically, hey, if there's a crime that's predicated on a dislike of somebody's race, ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, et cetera, you need to collect that stat, and or at least the FBI needs to collect that stat from the local and state law enforcement agencies. But the law doesn't compel the local police and local sheriff's deputies to actually submit it. So you have a sort of system where the FBI is supposed to go out and get it, but the local police and law enforcement don't actually have to submit it or submit accurate data on these crimes.
So they're not compelled, but is learning about hate crimes or preventing hate crimes a part of training for most local police or law enforcement?
In California, there's real training through the police academy system about hate crimes. Other states define hate crimes differently. So, for example, Alabama doesn't have a hate crimes law that protects gay, lesbian, transgender folks. And so even in terms of police going out and seeing what would be considered a hate crime in California, they're not going to consider certain incidents in Alabama a hate crime. And so I think training is absolutely a thing. Also, there's just no unification of the state laws. The state laws are all over the place.
I'm speaking with ProPublica's A.C. Thompson and Ken Schwenke, who've been tracking the surge in hate crimes for ProPublica and found that it's difficult to get an accurate count. Given these kind of gaps in reporting, do we know that there are more hate crimes happening, or are there just more being reported since the election?
So it depends, right? So if you go back and look at the FBI statistics, many places never report, right? And so it is hard to get an exact level on whether hate crimes are going up or down all over the place. But we do know that a number of hate crimes reported to the police and then further reported to the FBI have gone up. And we do know that in places like in New York, right, the law enforcement agencies there have said that they have seen an increase at their local levels, and further organizations that track this, such as the Southern Poverty Law Center, have said that they have seen an increase in reports to them.
You mentioned New York Governor Mario Cuomo. He launched a toll-free hotline to report incidents, set up a hate crimes unit. More than 400 calls since it launched last Friday. How are other officials responding in other states?
You know, it's interesting. A lot of states have been very, very quiet about this, and I think a lot of Republican officials and people, for example, in the Trump sphere have really not said a lot about this. There is a theory that's circulating on right-wing websites that these hate crimes are all sort of a conspiracy to discredit the incoming president. So that's the sort of state of discourse in some places.
Well, how has the Trump campaign responded? I mean, some of these are directly connected to Trump's victory, some claiming very overtly, you know, now that our man Trump is elected, it's time to organize a vigilante squad against diversity. Several students at UPenn received invitations to a daily lynching last week, now that Trump is president. So how has the Trump team responded?
I don't think we've seen any real response from the Trump team. You know, I think if you're an incoming leader, there could be the risk of overblowing clearly a negative story and blowing it up. But I think also as a incoming leader, one of the things that you want to do is say, hey, you know, I was elected and I intend to be the president for all people here. And I don't really think that that has happened in regards to speaking out against hate crimes by the current incoming administration.
Well, readers are invited to share their tips or other information on hate crimes to you, is it, AC?
Yeah, that'd be great. It's ac.thompson, T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N, at propublica.org.
And we'll put a link to that and the article by Ken Schwenke, data journalist with ProPublica, and AC Thompson, who's a staff writer. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Here's a scary scenario, an asteroid hurtling towards greater Los Angeles.
What is this thing?
It's enormous.
It's an asteroid, sir. It's the size of Texas, Mr. President.
What kind of damage?
Total, sir.
My God.
Nothing would survive.
And no, this is not the trailer for a Hollywood blockbuster, but a worst-case planetary protection exercise conducted this fall by representatives from NASA, FEMA, the Air Force, and other government agencies. The group simulation was designed to run through likely consequences, defenses, and on-the-ground responses to an asteroid colliding with a densely populated region. Lindley Johnson is Planetary Defense Officer at NASA HQ. And Lindley, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So scientists in this simulation knew the asteroid was on course to collide with the Earth since 2016, four full years before the simulation. Would we likely have that kind of advanced knowledge?
Well, that's sort of the whole purpose of our program here at NASA, is to find well in advance any asteroid that might be an impact hazard to the Earth far enough in advance that we would have time to mount a deflection mission.
And would there be enough time to do anything 4 years on?
Well, 4 years is pretty tight, and that's why in this exercise we weren't able to do anything about it before it would impact the Earth. Of course, this exercise was designed for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and so, of course, we had to exercise them and their processes and procedures. We had to have something impact the Earth.
Okay, so when you say we couldn't do anything, we couldn't send a team led by Bruce Willis to destroy the asteroid. So what are the other possible means of deflection or interruption of an asteroid bound for Earth that NASA has worked through?
Well, one of the first fallacies of the Hollywood movies is sending a crew to an asteroid to do this. That would not be necessary at all. It would be done by robotic spacecraft. And there are two leading techniques that we call them for deflecting asteroids. One is what we call a kinetic impactor deflection. That's just hitting an asteroid with a spacecraft enough to change its velocity by just a little bit. And that's really the whole basis of doing a deflection. You just need to change the speed at which the asteroid is moving so that 2 or 3 years down the road, when it reaches the same point that the Earth, it is late to the encounter.
So do we have kinetic impactors on hand?
No, we have nothing that is permanently ready for this. It's really not necessary. But we are developing those types of capabilities and demonstrating that these techniques could be effective. We have in our development now a mission called the Asteroid Impact Deflection Assessment Mission. It's a collaborative mission with the European Space Agency to demonstrate the effectiveness of a kinetic impactor.
So in this scenario, this exercise this fall, how big was the asteroid heading for Earth?
Well, when we first detected it, we didn't know exactly what the size would be. That's part of the challenge of this, is as we first see these objects, we only see a point in light moving across the sky. And it takes more observations over time to be able to determine the size and composition of the asteroid, and therefore the mass that we would be dealing with. That's probably the most important parameter, is understanding how significant the mass is of the asteroid, because that then determines how much force you have to apply against it to change its velocity.
Mm-hmm. And how about the projected damage, you know, the impact once it hits Earth in this, you know, greater LA region for this exercise?
Yeah. As the exercise progressed, we learned more and more about the asteroid. One, by doing a flyby mission of it, quickly sending a spacecraft out to flyby it and gather as much information as we could. And through that process, it was determined that in this hypothetical scenario, the asteroid was only about 100 to 120 meters, about 300 feet in size. But even so, that, you know, that's the size of a football field. And an object that size hitting in the middle of a metropolitan area would pretty much wipe out the entire city.
What if an asteroid were heading straight for an American city? Well, that disaster scenario was played out by NASA, FEMA, and other government groups in an emergency planning exercise in California this fall. We're speaking with NASA's Lindley Johnson, filling us in on what they learned there. What if it hit right off the coast?
Well, then if it would hit in deep enough water off the coast, that could cause a small tsunami wave to inundate at least the low-lying areas along the coast.
I'm seeing things here, you know, equivalent to a 50-megaton explosion, large shock wave, devastate the region for miles around, leveling structures for how far around?
Oh, out to about 10 miles, most structures would be leveled. It's the speed at which these objects are traveling. It's traveling at about 12 to 15 miles a second, and all of that kinetic energy being released as it hits the Earth is what causes it to be explosion equivalent to a large nuclear device.
Well, of course, you're doing this. NASA participated in this with FEMA and other agencies. So FEMA, they come up with a plan to evacuate, what, 18 million people living in the area?
Well, that's one of the challenges they might be faced with, given this type of scenario. One of the things, though, once we detect the object, we can pretty precisely tell them when it's going to happen so that they have sufficient time to plan such an evacuation. Also, protection of critical infrastructure, shutting down oil pipelines and things like that.
Well, Lindley, the FEMA administrator, Craig Fugate, said of this, you know, it is critical to exercise these kinds of low probability but high consequence disaster scenarios. So how low probability? What are the real chances of an asteroid of that size striking the Earth?
Well, luckily, an asteroid that size would not happen very often. Of course, the Earth gets hit with small stuff all the time. The meteor that you can go out and see every night in the sky, or the very small end of these natural objects. An object 100 meters or so in size, luckily an event like that might only occur once in 1,000 years. However, we don't know when that next event is. And so that's why our program is mainly designed to survey what is out there to give us as much advanced warning as we can. Objects down to 100 meters or so in size, our estimates of the population show us that there could be as many as 25 or 26,000 of them that are in orbits that come close to the Earth's orbit. And we've only found about 7,000 of them so far, so we have a little ways to go with our survey efforts.
Yeah. Well, we remember, you know, the asteroid exploding over this Russian city, Chelyabinsk, in 2013. Remember, you know, of course, caught on all the dash cams, shattering windows.
That was an object only 20 meters in size.
So just imagine 300 feet. But, Lindley, if this is such a low probability, I mean, why so many simulations? This must cost a lot of money.
Well, we've not had so many simulations. We've had three in a period of about 6 years. And also, these are simply tabletop exercises where we design a scenario, a model what the effects might be, and then and gather a group of experts in a room to present them the elements of the scenario and discussion then about what needs to be taken into account, what the challenges might be, and where they should focus their future planning.
So if anything is heading for us, you're going to let us all know, right?
That's our job here at NASA, is to find them as early as possible.
Lindley Johnson, NASA Planetary Defense Officer, thank you for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
You can find links to more on NASA and FEMA's emergency planning meeting for asteroid impact. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Cannonball, North Dakota is home to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation and site of tense clashes between law enforcement and people protesting the completion of the Dakota Access Pipeline. In August, North Dakota Governor Jack Dalrymple declared a state of emergency, activating the National Guard to, as he put it, maintain the peace. The declaration also triggered an influx of out-of-state personnel in accordance with a federal law providing interstate emergency assistance during natural disasters. Steve Horn is investigative journalist and research fellow at DSMOG blog and looked into how that law is being used not just for catastrophes, but for fighting protesters. Steve, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So this is called the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, or EMAC. Give us a little background on the law and what it does.
Sure. So a compact can exist because of a clause in the Constitution which allows states to enter into these sorts of mutually beneficial agreements, and they exist for all kinds of things. This one was passed into law 20 years ago, mostly because of massive hurricanes that were happening at that time. And so Congress and then President Bill Clinton passed this bill. Mostly has been used for hurricanes and other natural disasters. There's a small clause within it which allows for its use also for enemy combatants or insurgencies who come in the United States. And so I think that language activated its use in more recent years, looking about a year ago, 2015. In Baltimore, it was used during the Black Lives Matter protests there surrounding Freddie Gray. And now today, with the protests at Standing Rock, it's been activated because of the emergency order that was signed by the governor in North Dakota. It's allowed for six different states to send in officers from mostly county agencies or state highway patrols into North Dakota. So it's about 100 total of agents who are in the state, plus 100 more from the National Guard. So we're looking at about 200 people as the North Dakota National Guard, so 100 out of state, 100 from North Dakota, plus local agencies who are there. So probably about 250 to 300 officers are involved.
So not a national disaster, clearly, used for the Freddie Gray the Baltimore protests after Freddie Gray's death, and here at Standing Rock. But how about with national disasters? Is it frequently invoked for those?
Yes. It's whenever there's a big hurricane, for example, it's put in use. There's really never any controversy over its use. Just more recently, it's been used for protests, and it could become more of a trend. There's some controversy over whether or not we should use federal dollars for this, and so this dodges having to use federal dollars, but then a state like North Dakota pays the bill. So it's up to about $4 million spent on these out-of-state law enforcement agents and potentially growing as the protests continue.
Okay, so the state that declares the emergency pays the bill for these out-of-state? Okay.
Yeah. And they're not happy about that. They're asking for federal funding, but it's unclear whether or not the federal government has really given any funding to date.
How about the home cities and towns where these officers are coming from? I'm guessing that they're needed where they are.
Yeah, and so there is protests in particular in the state of Minnesota, in particular a county called Hennepin County, where local and state officials are upset that they were sent out in this way. I know here in Indiana, officers are being sent from Indianapolis, which is already There's violence in this city that law enforcement officers have to attend to, and also people, you know, officers from Northeast Indiana and Chicagoland area, which there's plenty of violence and crime in that area of the state. So, I mean, where, you know, it's been controversial for sure. It's invoked protests as a backlash against them going out of state to do this. So it's not, now there's actually a protest over their use to go to the protests in North Dakota.
Well, how about conduct? I'm just wondering what the difference is in managing and employing a force that's from out of state, you know, don't necessarily know the turf. And maybe if you have it, any data on whether these EMAC out-of-state personnel might be more often involved in confrontations with protesters?
So there's been, in general, lots of dissatisfaction over the use of sort of militarized gear. It's, I think there's still so many questions to be answered that it's hard to even answer these questions over what the protocol was. Did the rules of their home states apply, or did the rules of North Dakota apply in terms of conduct? And this is all happening, of course, during an election cycle. There were far less eyes on this maybe than there would have been in a normal period. And so we're still really just kind of catching up on everything that just took place and is taking place in Standing Rock. So I think that, like I said, there's so many more questions to be answered on that particular question.
Steve Horn, investigative journalist and research fellow at DSmog Blog. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Steve's article, This Natural Disaster Assistance Law is Why Other States Are Policing Dakota Access Pipeline Protests. And you'll find a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's time for The Bookshelf. Peter Biello speaks with authors who live or write about the Granite State. This week, he spoke with Katrina Kennison from Peterborough. She's an author and the longtime editor of the Best American Short Stories anthology. Here's an excerpt from their conversation.
Let's talk a little bit about your time as editor of the Best American Short Stories series. You did this for 16 years. That's, for listeners who aren't familiar with it, that's an annual collection of about, is it you, always 20? 20 short stories?
Always 20.
Always 20 short stories chosen by a guest editor from a smaller pool that you create, having read thousands a year. How many thousands exactly do you think you've read over the course of the 16 years you did this job?
All right, well, I'll give you the numbers and you do the math.
Okay.
I would read about 2,000 short stories a year, and I did this job for 16 years, so it was a lot of short stories. And I did not read every short story all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
I got pretty good at knowing within a few pages, you know, if the voice just isn't there, then chances are this is not going to be a contender for the best of the year. But I tried to give every story that I read a good, fair chance.
So tell us, from your perspective, what makes a good short story?
Well, Martha Foley, who was the second editor, she was asked that question, and her curt answer was, a good short story is one that's not too long and gives the reader the sense of having undergone an experience. So I would certainly agree with that. Probably also add that there's a sense of urgency or even necessity when you read a really good short story, that it's bringing you some news of the human condition that you need to have, that you need to know in order to grow or deepen in empathy or understand something that was beyond your grasp before. So I think of it as kind of urgent news of the human condition.
Was there ever a story where, I mean, you call from the 2,000 you read, what, 100 for the guest editor?
120.
120. Was there ever a story among those 120 that you're like, oh, I really hope this one gets in, but then it doesn't?
Oh, of course.
Can you name one of those?
No, I can't name one of those. that would come up year after year. And different guest editors had different ways of working. And some of them really wanted to get right down in the trench and tussle over the stories. And that was
tussle
always,
with you? Like,
yeah,
discuss? Okay.
Yeah, discuss. And that was always so much fun because we could really debate the merits of a particular story and the balance of the collection. And those would be collaborative efforts, and other guest editors wanted to go away and read and pick and call me with the results and be done with it. And either way was fine.
Can you give me some examples of the guest editors that fall in either category? Who are some of the collaborative authors?
Well, Ann Patchett was the final guest editor I had the pleasure of working with, and the two of us just hit it off from the very beginning and so enjoyed the process of both reading together and getting to know each other's tastes and sharing our thoughts about the short story. So it was a wonderful way to end. And John Updike, with this mammoth project that we co-edited together, he often asked me my thoughts. He had narrowed it down to two stories by Bernard Malamud, and I got a little postcard in the mail from him, which he would type on his old Underwood typewriter, and it said, "Dear Miss Kennison, I would love to know which of the Bernard Malamud stories you prefer and why." And only my husband knew that I would take that as quite a literary assignment. You know, John Updike wants to know my thoughts, so I'm going to go and read those two stories again very carefully and spend a good day or two getting straight in my own mind which one I prefer.
So what about from the other column, the authors who would rather just, okay, give me the 120, I'll pick them and let you know?
Garrison Keillor just had a very clear sense of how he wanted to do it, and he chose wonderful stories, and we worked really well together, but he was not so interested. Jane Smiley was not so interested in what I had to think, and it was really fine. My job as the series editor was to meet the guest editor wherever they were, and every one of them brought a very particular taste and sensibility to the series, which is what kept it and keeps it so lively year after year. It's never about one person's tastes or predilections.
Mm-hmm. My personal interaction with the book, I discovered the series while you were the editor when I was in high school. And I think the first one that I encountered was Barbara Kingsolver.
Yeah.
She was the editor that year. And the stories were just great. I mean, when I was done with my school required reading, like, that's what I was flipping through, thinking, like, this is great stuff. Why isn't everybody reading this? Why aren't we assigned this?
That's exactly right. Yeah. There are so many authors I heard from over the years, and one of the great perks of the job was getting to contact authors who had been chosen and let them know that they were going to have a story in the Best American Short Stories. And invariably, those authors would say, "I've been reading this series ever since I was in high school, and it's always been a dream of mine to have a story included." So it's wonderful to be the bearer of happy news.
Yeah. Okay, so I didn't realize that you were the one who got to tell them that. Are there any other reactions that just stick in your mind, author reactions?
Well, John Updike, my very first year that I was serving in this role as series editor, and I was working with Alice Adams, and there is a beautiful John Updike story called A Sandstone Farmhouse, another one of my all-time favorites. And he had just won the Pulitzer Prize weeks before. And I, as the new editor of this series, now had to contact by phone Mr. Updike and let him know his story had been chosen. And his graciousness, it just melted me. He said, "I haven't been in for quite some time, and this is such an honor. I was beginning to worry that I might never have a story in the Best American Short Stories again." So he was completely humbled and delighted, nothing jaded about his response at all.
Peter Biello there with an excerpt from The Bookshelf. You can listen to the full episode with Katrina Kennison and hear about her new memoir, Moments of Seeing, by downloading the podcast on iTunes or Google Play. Thank you so much for spending some time listening today. Music in this episode came to us from Jason Leonard, Blue Dot Sessions, and Poddington Bear. So I did see my first ever Harry Potter-related movie over the holiday weekend, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. I blame a 15 and a 19-year-old for the choice, but it was kind of adorable. We'd like to know which movies you're looking forward to seeing this holiday season. Is it Rogue One, the new Star Wars story? Passengers? Bad Santa 2? You can let us know. We're Word of Mouth Radio on Facebook and at Word of Mouth on Twitter. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.